The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can do that. That's your weekend assignment anyway. Send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, we have so much to get to today, so much that we might make this a commercial-free broadcast. 55 minutes, nonstop. We'll see. We've got quite a few clips to get to, so that's going to take up some of our time as well. 7 years ago, tomorrow, December 10th, 2009, this was during his first year as President of the United States, Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples.
I receive this honor with deep gratitude and great humility. It's an award that speaks to our highest aspirations, that for all the cruelty and hardship of our world, we are not mere prisoners of fate. Our actions matter and can bend history in the direction of justice.
He accepted that award at the end of 2009, but it's interesting that he was nominated for the prize just weeks into his presidency. I think the Nobel Committee had closed the nomination process 2 weeks after the inauguration. And so here was a man who had done nothing yet as president, literally nothing. And it's like he won the Most Valuable Player award before the game had even started. He was rewarded essentially for what he had promised to do. He was rewarded for the rhetoric. No achievements, just lots of talk, endless talk about peace. And the Nobel Committee loved it. They heaped praise upon him for all of the verbiage, all of the talk about a nuclear weapons-free world. President Obama, the committee said, had created a new climate in international politics. Democracy, he said, and human rights were being strengthened, or that's what the committee said, that he was strengthening democracy around the world and had created a more peaceful climate. Well, as you just heard there, he came into office promising humility. He said he would listen to America's adversaries, quite unlike some of his predecessors during his first year in office. In particular, he was traversing the globe on the tour of apology, one apology after another. In Prague, he called for the end of nuclear proliferation. In France, he told a group of students that America in the past had shown arrogance and had been dismissive, even derisive, he said. And then who can forget about the Cairo speech? This shameless appeal to the world of Islam. In that particular speech, he basically apologized for the West's reaction following the attack on 9/11, apologizing for the way the West responded to the attack on 9/11. He said, in some cases, it led us to act contrary to our traditions and our ideals. Of course, implying that we shouldn't have gone into Iraq in the first place. Who knows about Afghanistan? But he said that the previous administration had made a series of hasty decisions based on fear rather than foresight. They didn't have the vision. They didn't have the foresight to see where all of these actions in response to the greatest terrorist attack on U.S. soil, well, the greatest attack since Pearl Harbor. America under President Obama, we heard in 2009, would now extend the right hand of fellowship to the world of Islam. It would press the reset button with Vladimir Putin's Russia. And on and on and on it went. All the way through that year, 2009 that is, to when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He won the top prize for bringing peace to this earth. Here's another statement from his address before the Nobel Committee. This is clip two.
One urgent example is the effort to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and to seek a world without them. In the middle of the last century, nations agreed to be bound by a treaty whose bargain is clear. All will have access to peaceful nuclear power. Those without nuclear weapons will forsake them, and those with nuclear weapons will work towards disarmament. I am committed to upholding this treaty. It is a centerpiece of my foreign policy.
And so he talked a lot about that in his first year, nuclear disarmament, stating flatly that, well, all those who don't have nuclear weapons, they'll forsake them. They won't go after them. They won't try to build them. And those of us that have them, we'll dismantle them. He made the same point before the United Nations, just a couple of months before the acceptance of that Nobel Prize. This is clip three.
In an era when our destiny is shared, power is no longer a zero-sum game. No one nation can or should try to dominate another nation.
And so America needed to be knocked down some notches, and the playing field needed to be leveled. That's what he said in September 2009. The next year, April 2010, this is about a year after his pledge in Prague to seek after a world that had no nuclear weapons. He told the New York Times in 2010 that he would not use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear state, even if that nation attacked the U.S., even if that nation attacked the U.S. with biological or chemical weapons. He stated up front, well, of course, we're not going to use our nukes. Which just flew right in the face of traditional policy, foreign policy, for a U.S. president. This is part of his doctrine, though. You could call it the Obama doctrine, where it just puts all of America's cards right out there on the table for everyone in the world to see. Charles Krauthammer, he wrote in response to that revelation in 2010 that it's like saying that if a terrorist deliberately uses his car to mow down 100 people waiting at a bus stop, the decision as to whether he gets A, hanged, or B, 100 hours of community service hinges entirely on whether his car had passed emissions inspections. He went on to say, does anyone believe that North Korea or Iran will be more persuaded to abjure nuclear weapons because they could then carry out a biological or chemical attack on the U.S. without fear of nuclear retaliation? Well, history, as we know, is repeating itself. There were other things. There was the Pentagon's nuclear posture review. This also happened in 2010 where the president had concluded that, well, the greatest threat now to global security is not a nuclear exchange, but it's rather terrorism or someone getting a hold of a nuclear bomb, a dirty bomb. And, of course, we know what Jesus had to say about the greatest threat facing humanity. You can read about it in Matthew 24. But history's repeating itself for sure. No matter the words, no matter how smooth-sounding the words are regarding the post-World War I disarmament movement, journalist Walter Lippmann, he observed this in 1943. He said it was tragically successful in disarming the nations that believed in disarmament. And so the United States has taken the lead these past 8 years in disarming the nukes And has the rest of the world followed in that path? Will this approach, this policy, turn out to be tragically successful, as Lippmann noted in 1943? Well, the world, as we've been pointing out on this program over and again, as the United States dismantles its nuclear program and downsizes its military, the rest of the world races to prepare for war, even world war. That's the reality. Another comment from 2009, when the president was accepting his Nobel Peace Prize. This is clip 4.
So even as we respect the unique culture and traditions of different countries, America will always be a voice for those aspirations that are universal. We will bear witness to the quiet dignity of reformers like Aung San Suu Kyi, to the bravery of Zimbabweans who cast their ballots in the face of beatings, to the hundreds of thousands who have marched silently through the streets of Iran. It is telling that the leaders of these governments fear the aspirations of their own people more than the power of any other nation. And it is the responsibility of all free people and free nations to make clear that these movements of hope and history, they have us on their side.
These movements, the Green Revolution in particular, these hundreds of thousands of Iranians that took to the streets, marching silently, as he said there, they have the United States on their side. They have America's backing, he said, 6 months after the Ayatollahs crushed the so-called Green Revolution. And during the time of the revolution, during the time of the uprising, this administration offered no support, not even one word of support. And he explained, if you go back to, this one here is from the speech he gave in Cairo. This was from June 4th, 2009. Listen to this first. This is clip 9.
Rather than remain trapped in the past, I've made it clear to Iran's leaders and people that my country is prepared to move forward.
That's what he said just before this democratic uprising, June 4th, 2009. Of course, you know everything that we said about the Cairo speech, how that this was helping the terrorist cause, not hurting it. And my father was saying how this is a great turning point in the world. That speech he gave in Cairo, June 2009, how that it's going to lead to terrifying prophecies being fulfilled. Well, just going back to the timeline for a moment, just days after he gave that speech, the mullahs rigged the presidential election to make sure Ahmadinejad stayed in power. That was on June 12th, 8 days after the Cairo speech. And it prompted tens of thousands of Iranians to take to the streets. They weren't exactly protesting quietly. They were shouting, "Death to the dictator." They were chanting, "Give us our votes back." And they were thinking, no doubt many of them, they were thinking, we have the United States of America supporting us. Surely, it's a democratic uprising. Surely, it's a movement standing firm against tyranny. Al Jazeera described the situation on June 13th as the biggest unrest since the 1979 revolution. Boy, you talk about an opportunity for America to actually advance the cause of peace. Well, that revolution, that uprising, was squashed almost as fast as it started. And how did the president respond? I mean, you heard what he said there in Cairo, in accepting the Nobel Peace Prize late in the year. But as the uprising was happening, here's what the president had to say. This is clip 8.
So do you have anything to say, any message to send to the people who are in the streets protesting, who believe their votes were stolen and who are being attacked violently?
obviously all of us have been watching the news from Iran. And I want to start off by being very clear that it is up to Iranians to make decisions about who Iran's leaders will be, that we respect Iranian sovereignty and want to avoid the United States being the issue inside of Iran.
So here is this popular uprising, and it's brutally smashed by this radical Islamist regime. And his response during that time, during the uprising, was basically to say that, well, it's for the Iranian people to decide. In other words, the regime, and I mean, the leaders of the uprising were arrested. Some of them were thrown in prison. The government says 36 people were killed during the protests. Others have claimed it's more like 150. Thousands of arrests targeting the leaders, the democratic leaders of the protests. And the United States basically saying, look, we want to avoid being the issue here. This is up to Iran to decide. Notice what else he said. This was the following day, June 16th, 2009, clip 10.
You've seen in Iran some initial reaction from the Supreme Leader that indicates he understands the Iranian people have deep concerns about the election. It's not productive, given the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, to be seen as meddling, the U.S. president meddling in Iranian elections.
That's the president of the United States there defending the Supreme Leader, because he understood what was happening, and he knew there were some irregularities in the voting, and the Supreme Leader's going to look into it. And it's not productive, given the history that we've had with Iran, for us to be seen as meddling. And so hundreds of thousands of protesters left hanging out to dry, basically. And then a few months later, he lets the world know after the fact that we support them. We support those democratic uprisings. But he offered not one word of support when it was actually happening. Of course, we now know, as I covered on this program a few months ago, we now know that the reason he stood up for and defended the Supreme Leader early on in his presidency is because he was determined, he was obsessed with making peace with the Ayatollah. And of course, that all came to fruition just this past year, January 16th, 2016. And we know what they did to sell the American people on this deal, to sell Congress on this deal. Fake news. You hear a lot about that in the news today. The Democrats all of a sudden are very concerned about it. Fake news. Ben Rhodes admitted as much. Yeah, we created a fake story, a false narrative, because we had to get this through. We had to make this deal with the Supreme Leader. So that's why there was no support for these protesters. There in mid-June 2009, an estimated 500,000 people took to the streets. The biggest unrest since 1979. And the United States, the world's lone superpower, completely silent. Completely silent. When the regime, the number one sponsor of terrorism in the world, very, very, very nearly toppled. And the United States completely silent. It's quite a contrast to how vocal the United States was just a year and a half later. in the early stages of the so-called Arab Spring. And what President Obama said and what his administration did to support those popular uprisings against leaders that were American allies, not the number one state sponsor of terror, but allies with the United States, allies even with Israel. In that case, Egypt, Israel, for some 30 years. And it was the United States, despite that history, that forced Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak out of office. And then after the fact, President Obama, of course, coming forward to boast about America's great achievement. This is clip 11.
I think history will end up recording that at every juncture in the situation in Egypt, that we were on the right side of history.
The right side of history. He lopped off the leadership of Mubarak, gave rise to the Muslim Brotherhood. And today, of course, Egypt is tottering on the brink. It's increasingly more and more unstable. And, of course, we know Bible prophecy says that eventually it's going to be closely allied with Iran. And the chances for that, well, we know it's not a matter of chance. It's prophesied. But it's made a lot easier now, this alliance, with Mubarak out of the way. Well, you can just move through the region, the Middle East, I mean, North Africa, after the plans were in motion to finish the withdrawal from Iraq. This was the end of 2011. Here's what President Obama had to say about that. This is clip 12.
Indeed, everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting and all the dying, the bleeding and the building and the training and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success.
Iraq was a great success. It was a moment of success back in December 2011. Today, of course, Iraq is a battleground, an intense one at that, a bloody battleground. Syria is even worse. With Syria, I mean, President Obama made it clear up front that if Assad didn't play by the rules, America would intervene. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize drew a red line and said, no one crosses this red line. And if someone does, we act. The United States acts. Well, the United States didn't, of course, and now hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Hundreds of thousands more have fled to Europe and elsewhere. And now President Obama says he's actually proud that he didn't follow through on the red line, that he didn't keep his word. He's proud because, as he told Jeffrey Goldberg in an interview, he rejected the Washington playbook that presidents are supposed to follow. It's a playbook that comes out of the foreign policy establishment, and he went against it. He went against it by erasing the red line, and today he's proud of it. He's proud of it. He's proud of the fact that he handed the Middle East over to Russia. He's proud of the fact that he stepped aside and let Russia intervene to supposedly destroy all of Syria's chemical weapons. He's proud of the fact that Russia's propped up this puppet leader, and that Russia, together with Iran, pretty much controls the region. Charles Krauthammer, he said at the time, Moscow's become the grand central station for Middle East leaders seeking outside help in their various conflicts. That's who they're going to. That's who they're going to. They know the United States can't be counted on. I mean, before Syria, it was the United States who just turned a blind eye to what happened in Ukraine. As Russian troops moved right into Crimea, and not one thing was done, barely anything was said. Pretty amazing history. Recent history. History from the last 7-8 years. We haven't even talked yet about Libya. You know the story there. President Obama acting unilaterally, saying that he was forced to act. I mean, a massacre was coming, he said, in, of all places, Benghazi. And so we've got to intervene. We've got to get rid of Gaddafi. And so he did do that in 2011, I believe. And then talked about how successful that mission was soon after. This is clip 13.
Our brave pilots have flown in Libya's skies. Our sailors have provided support off Libya's shores. And our leadership at NATO has helped guide our coalition. Without putting a single U.S. service member on the ground, we achieved our objectives. And our NATO mission will soon come to an end.
Another so-called victory for the United States that's now obviously an infamous failure of epic proportions, as Libya has turned into a terrorist safe haven. Thousands upon thousands have been murdered following this so-called victory, including the attack, of course, on Benghazi, our own consulate, where we lost an ambassador. The first time that's happened, an assassination like that, first time it's happened, what was it, 30 years or so? Three others died along with him. And, of course, in that particular episode, the United States did virtually nothing. All those requests for backup, for help, for assistance. And then, of course, the night of the attack. And you have a president gone missing. You have a secretary of state who earlier had bragged about taking out Gaddafi. You know, we came, he died, and so on. And then where was the support for Americans in Benghazi? Nowhere to be found. And then all the lies that followed. Well, it was an election year, 2012, so we had to cover it up. What a disaster. In every respect, what a disaster. And today, as I say, it's a terrorist safe haven. You've got refugees jumping into the Mediterranean, just like they're fleeing Syria. They're trying to get out of Libya, too, and get across into Europe. It's such a disaster. Going back to this Nobel Peace Prize acceptance, this was in December, December 10th, 7 years tomorrow. Tomorrow will be the 7-year anniversary since President Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize. Is a White House press representative, by the way. Last week he was asked if the president looks back on this and feels like he's deserving, still deserving of the award. And the press secretary said, well, yes, he's lived up to the goals of that award. He's lived up to the ideals, for sure. Go back and look at his speech. Well, we're doing that. This is from that acceptance, clip 5.
Let me also say this. The promotion of human rights cannot be about exhortation alone. At times, it must be coupled with painstaking diplomacy. I know that engagement with repressive regimes lacks the satisfying purity of indignation. But I also know that sanctions without outreach, condemnation without discussion, can carry forward only a crippling status quo. No repressive regime can move down a new path unless it has the choice of an open door.
That's the Obama doctrine in a nutshell. They all get an open door. Doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter the atrocities, the horrific acts. Everyone gets an open door. Iran, Russia, Cuba. And the list goes on and on. Cuba, perhaps, is the most recent example of this particular doctrine, this approach. Even Richard Cohen at the Washington Post, I don't think he's the most conservative columnist around. But he's shocked here at the response to Fidel Castro's death. We've talked a fair bit about this in the last 2 weeks. He says here in these 223 words that the White House released following Castro's death, he says, it is blank of moral judgment, empty of indignation, blind to injustice, dismissive of history, and indifferent to injury. A dictator has died. And Barack Obama sent him off with lazy words, lazy weasel words, he says. Quoting the White House then, history will record and judge the enormous impact of this singular figure on the people and the world around him. Cohen says history will also record Obama's failure to condemn. Well, Cohen, I think, is a little bit off in saying that the Obama doctrine is just simply a failure to condemn, because this administration has proven to be, well, quite strong when it comes to condemning certain adversaries. But when it comes to these dictators abroad, he's right about this. Failure to condemn. These words. History will record and judge the enormous impact of this singular figure on the people and the world around him. He could have said the same thing about John Glenn yesterday. It was as if Castro was right up there with the American hero John Glenn. Cohen says, I call this inert White House statement the Obama doctrine because it nicely encapsulates the president's lack of indignation. No drama Obama, as he's been called. Has an occasional moral moment, but not often. He says later, the president has abided the Syrian slaughter without showing much disgust. He drew a red line around Bashar al-Assad's use of poison gas and then walked away from it. And that's the way that it's been. Doesn't matter what Iran does, how much they humiliate our sailors. And this is something that you see around the world. Look at the way the Filipino president has said things about President Obama just this year. And now he'd rather go out to ally himself with Russia or China. Japan's moving in the same direction. Russia, of course, has been given free rein in the Middle East and in parts of Eastern Europe. We've shunned our allies like in Israel, Saudi Arabia. We've been humiliated in South Sudan. Tiny little nations. Everywhere in the world, just like Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong said in the United States and Britain in prophecy, everywhere that you look, the United States is disrespected. He was writing US and BP back in 1981. That was the last version that came out, saying even little Vietnam, North Vietnam, I mean, even that tiny little nation, we can't even whip them, he said. What would Mr. Armstrong be saying today? Here we are, withdrawing to a 1930s-style isolationist position, pulling back from Europe, George Friedman, he said just recently, the last time the world looked like this was on the eve of World War II. Crises simmering in Europe, Russia, the Middle East, China. And they're all beginning, as he said, they're all beginning to interact with each other. And there's nothing to stop the momentum of these crises. Friedman said the global order is poised for a major reconfiguration. Well, we talked about that yesterday in Europe. Europe's coming reconfiguration. It is poised and ready. Charles Krauthammer, he wrote, this isn't from his column this week. I didn't see that one yet, but this is from last week. I didn't get to this. But he titled his piece, "After a Mere 25 Years, the Triumph of the West is Over." He goes back to December 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and how that this marked the ultimate triumph of the liberal democratic idea. How the West was rejoicing and celebrating. And Krauthammer and others thought, you know, his generation, he says, never thought that would even be possible. But he says in his piece from last week, that era is over. He writes here, the autocracies are back and rising. Democracy's on the defensive. The U.S. is in retreat. Look no further than Aleppo, a Western-backed resistance to a local tyrant backed by a resurgent Russia, an expanding Iran, and an array of proxy Shiite militias is on the brink of annihilation. Russia drops bombs. America issues statements. What better symbol for the end of that heady liberal democratic historical moment? The West is turning inward and going home, leaving the field to the rising authoritarians, Russia, China, and Iran. In France, well, skipping a little further ahead here, it says even as Europe tires of the sanctions imposed on Russia for its rape of Ukraine, you see Europeans now wanting to make some kind of a deal with Russia. And, of course, that democratic club, as Krauthammer goes on to say, I mean, it's about to break up. He refers back to Brexit. Yesterday, of course, we talked about that referendum in Italy on Sunday. Says later, as for China, the other great challenger to the post-Cold War order, the administration's pivot has turned into an abject failure. The Philippines has openly defected to the Chinese side. Malaysia then followed. And the rest of our Asian allies are beginning to hedge their bets. When the president of China addressed the Pacific Rim countries in Peru last month, he suggested that China was prepared to pick up the pieces of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, now abandoned by both political parties in the United States. He says the West retreat began with Obama. Notice these points he makes in conclusion. The West retreat began with Obama, who reacted to perceived post-9/11 overreach by abandoning Iraq, offering appeasement to Russia, and accommodating Iran. He says in 2009 he refused even rhetorical support to the popular revolt against the rule of the Ayatollahs. And then Krauthammer says Donald Trump wants to continue to pull back, though for entirely different reasons. Obama ordered retreat because he's always felt the U.S. was not good enough for the world. Too flawed to have earned the moral right to be the world hegemon. Trump would follow suit, disdaining allies and avoiding conflict because the world's not good enough for us. Undeserving, ungrateful, parasitic foreigners living safely under our protection and off our sacrifices. Time to look after our own American interests. Well, we can withdraw, as Krauthammer says. For whatever the reason, whether it's the Obama doctrine or the Trump doctrine, we can withdraw, but these problems are not going to go away. It's not going to make the world a peaceful, more stable place. Look at what's happening. Look at what's happening in the world. 7 years on, almost 8 years, the Nobel Peace Prize the prize for peace, for bringing peace to this earth. Here again is what President Obama said December 10th, 2009. This is clip six.
It's also why the world must come together to confront climate change. There's little scientific dispute that if we do nothing, we will face more drought, more famine, more mass displacement, all of which will fuel more conflict for decades.
Now, as far as following through on action, following through and acting on these statements from that acceptance speech, well, on this point, he definitely has followed through. This piece here from the Washington Free Beacon just earlier this week, it says the Obama administration has put forth 25 so-called midnight regulations, which will cost the economy $44 billion. These midnight regulations, it's what the lame duck administration tries to hurry and force in before they leave at Inauguration Day. It says here the $44 billion in regulatory costs have overshot that estimate by more than eight times. And it was estimated to be $5 billion. It was estimated to be $5 billion earlier this year. Well, it's eight times that now, as they hurry and try to get more of their regulations in place. Free Beacon says the administration's final regulatory agenda includes $75 billion in costs, which includes the cost of the midnight regulations, but has added to the $150 billion in regulatory costs the administration has produced already this year. And the priorities, I mean, it goes toward the Affordable Care Act, a majority of Dodd-Frank, and then dozens of rules aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to save the world. We've got to save the earth. It says some of the key rules involve efficiency standards for the Department of Energy, corporate average fuel economy, and all these things for the Department of Transportation and so on. They're following through on their agenda. They see the greatest threat to this earth as being climate change. Never mind the debate, never mind democracy even. Just impose the will on the American people, the will of this administration. Says the most expensive regulation put out during this time will go to the Department of Health and Human Services for a rule called the Protection of Human Subjects. This rule will cost $13 billion and is designed to better protect human subjects involved in research while facilitating valuable research and reducing burden, delay, and ambiguity for investigators. Midnight. What do they call it? The midnight regulations to fight against climate change and other things, too. You would think there'd be a few more people speaking out. You would think there'd be a few more people that are just absolutely beside themselves by what's happening here, right? In the last couple of months, going back to 2009, here again, is President Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. This is clip number seven.
Adhering to this law of love has always been the core struggle of human nature. For we are fallible. We make mistakes and fall victim to the temptations of pride and power and sometimes evil. Even those of us with the best of intentions will at times fail to right the wrongs before us. But we do not have to think that human nature is perfect for us to still believe that the human condition can be perfected.
And he certainly believes that it is being perfected. You listen to him or you listen to any of his representatives, and the world is so much better than it was 7.5, 8 years ago. It's become more tranquil, more peaceful. Sure, there's a few messy spaces on the earth, a few messy regions, I suppose, but we see things progressing. And so the way that they look at it, you get to the end of the road here, and, well, yes. Did did he live up to the ideals of that award? Well, yes. Yes, of course. Look at the progress that we're making. Look at the nukes that we've dismantled. Look at how we've scaled our military back. Look at how we've pulled out of these hotspots. Look at how we've opened up dialogue with Russia, with Iran. Of course, we know from Bible prophecy, Jesus said that it's this human nature that he referenced there. He certainly gets it right in the sense that we are fallible and that we do fail and that we do fall victim to the temptations of pride and power and evil. And the thing is, where is that leading? The heart is deceitful above all things, Jeremiah said, and it's desperately wicked. And it's because of that and these other prophecies, like the one in Matthew 24, 21, and 22, that we know where we're headed, whether it's the Obama doctrine or the Trump doctrine. It doesn't matter, but it certainly is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, seeing this weak leadership and all these curses setting in and all of these ascendant powers in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in Russia. It's heading right for Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. He said, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved." That's the direction that we're heading in, sad to say. But that's not the end of it all, we're happy to report. Because Jesus Christ is coming back to this earth to intervene and to cut those days short. That's the hope. That's the hope that we have to look forward to. All of this, of course, is culminating in the establishment of God's kingdom on this earth. The end of this fruitless and calamitous cycle. We're very nearly approaching the end of it, finally. Jesus said, for the elect's sake, those days of tribulation will be shortened. And that's when the God of heaven will set up a kingdom on this earth that will never be destroyed, as it says in Daniel 2, verse 44. That's when the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdoms of Jesus Christ, Revelation 11 and verse 15. Now, before all of that, of course, even when you look at these prophecies, or rather these events that have been happening, intensifying in the last 7 or 8 years. Of course, the Bible has a lot to say about so many of these as well. Iran's aggressive, terrorism-empowered foreign policy. Iran's ascendance in the Middle East as king of the Middle East. The prophesied strongman to appear out of Europe. We talked about that yesterday. The Bible has something to say about that. And of course, the clash between the King of the South, radical Islam, and the King of the North, that European superpower. And the Bible also has a lot to say about America's shameful weakness. I didn't bring the quote with me from United States and Britain in Prophecy, where Mr. Armstrong just talks about the magnitude of America's fall. The bigger they are, the harder they fall, as the saying goes. The Bible has a lot to say about our people's sins and how that sin is leading to all of this, these weapons of mass destruction. striking our own population centers. It even has a lot to say about survivors being taken away or deported as slaves. It's all there. It's all there. Well, as it turns out, we have a few minutes left. I guess we can go ahead and take a short break and then come back and wrap things up with a few emails that we didn't have time to get to over the last couple of programs. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to join the growing list of emailers, you can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
One of our listeners in Edmond, which is kind of funny, he sent me this this article from the International Churchill Society website, which had a piece there on the site about a Churchill exhibit at Stratford-upon-Avon. So he's there in Edmond telling me about this exhibit, this cool exhibit that's just down the road from us. In fact, Stratford Armories, it's actually not in Stratford proper, a little ways outside of Stratford-upon-Avon, closer, in fact, to Edstone. And I had heard of this this exhibit. It's only been there, I believe, since this past summer. But in any event, it sounds like, given what this particular piece has to say, it sounds like it's something I'll definitely be visiting soon. It says here, Winston Churchill and William Shakespeare, the two greatest Britons, are now both celebrated in the Bard's home of Stratford-upon-Avon, as the Stratford Armories have become host to one of the finest collections of Churchillian in existence, or Churchillian, it says. However you say that. It says Jack Dara gathered many of the best and rarest pieces celebrating Churchill's life and is now pleased to see them permanently housed in the museum, or a museum that preserves many elements of British military history. Goes on and talks about these two and some of the things that he's collected over the years. It says, long known as the birthplace, childhood home, and burial site of William Shakespeare, Stratford-upon-Avon receives tens of thousands of visitors each year who come not only to pay their respects to the world's greatest dramatist, but also to watch the plays performed by the Royal Shakespeare Company. Stratford has undergone a renaissance in recent years, starting with the magnificent remodeling of the Shakespeare Memorial Theater. New Place, the site of Shakespeare's house, reopened this summer after significant enhancements. All this, combined with the introduction to the Dara Harwood collection, it says, provides a splendid tribute to the two towers of English heritage. If you didn't have a good enough reason to visit Edstone, well, here's just another one. You can add to the pile of excuses to come see this beautiful region where God has placed his name. Beautiful Edstone, just down the street from Shakespeare's house, from Shakespeare's school, and also now this tremendous exhibit about Winston Churchill. Churchill and Shakespeare, the two greatest Britons. An email here from Massachusetts says, I'm just now listening to your discussions of Mozart, and I'm reminded immediately of Mr. Malone, Ryan Malone. I'm always amazed at the abundance and the quality of the output by this incredibly talented individual. I only have a moment to spotlight his and his supportive and equally talented family's work, but I think about this often. It says, as I follow his work, I can so clearly see the creativity, the work ethic, the knowledge, and the careful planning of God the Father. I'm so thankful to have access to the fruits of his labors, as well as the additional education that he always provides about the background of his work. The careful and detailed reasoning that went into it, the biblical and historical context, the musical principles, the heavenly types, and on. This concert that we went to a couple of weeks ago, put on by the Birmingham Symphony, the first half was Beethoven. Beautiful, wonderful sounds, beautiful music. And then the second half was a modern composer by the name of John Adams. And it was just this discordant mess of music. And as we were leaving, I don't know if I related this to you yet. I know I talked about that concert some, but as I was leaving the concert, I told my family, won't it be nice in the wonderful world tomorrow when you have a concert like that, where the first half, you know, one of the older ones, Beethoven, and then the second half, one of the newer composers like Ryan Malone. And what a wonderful concert that would be, putting the two together. This emailer, this listener here says, God's work through Mr. Malone has been such a blessing to behold, and I've wanted to write him about this for some time. His work has greatly impacted my life and that of the children of my family. I only wish I had time to detail it. I hope that all listeners will have the chance to take in the incredibly high-quality productions from this exceedingly talented modern composer. Well, with that, we come to the conclusion of yet another program. We're finishing up a week of broadcasting, in fact. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget about your weekend assignment, which is to send us an email. Tell us what you think about the program and where you listen from. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.